Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, and I am so freaking proud to bring this interview to you. Joining me today is a man who founded one of the top legendary firms in all of tech. He is the co-founder of Benchmark. It's a venture capital firm that invested most recently in companies including Uber and Snap. Historically, they've been known to have successes going all the way back to eBay and Juniper Networks. And here he is on Mixergy talking about a little bit about Benchmark and also about his new company. It's called Wealthfront. It's an automated investment service that's allowing people to invest in a really smart way. And I think younger and younger people are going to, in fact, they already have gravitated towards it. And I'm excited about it too. His name is Andy Ratcliffe, and I'm so proud to have him on here. I'll say that the two sponsors for this interview are the company that will help you hire great developers. It's called TopTal. And the second is the company that got me a beautiful design. My heart is exploding with pride from it. It's called Design Crowd, but I'll tell you more about those later. Andy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Which of the investments, and there's a long list, are you proudest of having made?
As a firm or myself?
Interesting. I was thinking as a firm, but why don't you broaden it out, including yourself too?
Well, let's see. It's hard to pick. They're like your children.
Mm-hmm.
As a firm, I think we've been really fortunate to make great investments, and the team that's making the investments today, I think, is doing an even better job than those of us who started the firm. So as you mentioned, companies like Snap and Uber, Twitter, it's just a fantastic list. I'd say personally, my two favorites were probably Juniper Networks, which really changed networking, mm-hmm. and a company called Equinix, which is a multi-billion dollar company, revenue company that no one's ever heard of, that actually makes the entire internet work.
Because?
Well, they are the peering centers or the hosting centers where all of the networks that comprise the internet interconnect with one another, and where internet companies can connect their content to those networks. It's a network effects business that is incredibly profitable and much, much larger than anyone would ever know.
So I ask people – I asked venture capitalists what they admired about Benchmark and what I should talk about. Here's what they said. They said things like, ask about the transition. This seemed, at least on the outside, like a really smooth transition. Ask about the shift away from Sand Hill Road to San Francisco. You guys made that move. Does Benchmark even have an office in Menlo Park?
It's in Woodside, the town next door.
In Woodside, okay. But the main office is San Francisco, right?
No, they're co-equals.
Okay, all right. Ask about why they didn't get big, right? So many other firms that started back then who succeeded got big, and about your opinion on the bull market. And I actually heard you tell Jason Calacanis in an interview a while back that you are still a believer in this market. Meanwhile, Bill Gurley, a partner at the firm, I've got tons of screenshots of him saying there is a bubble and he's worried about it. So I'd like to ask you about all those. And then I want to ask you why Wealthfront?
I can interpret Bill's comments for you.
You could?
Yes.
What is it?
You want me to start there?
Yeah, let's start there.
Well, I think that Bill feels very, very strongly that companies would be better served going public than they would raising money privately. Even Mark Zuckerberg, who was a vocal opponent to going public, has now changed his tune and said that he would have been much better served if he had gone public earlier because it added a level of discipline that really made Facebook better. And so Bill is of the belief, as am I, as I think are most very good venture capitalists, that companies benefit from going public. And by the way, it keeps the entire venture capital world going. If companies don't go public, we can't generate the liquidity for our limited partners to keep raising funds. Why should they give us money if we never get liquidity?
But isn't he also saying that there's I don't remember the details of this, but I did hear him in an interview with Recode, I think it was, with Kara Swisher, saying there's just too much money out there, and that's part of the bubble.
Well, there's always been too much money chasing too few deals. So I graduated business school in 1984 at Stanford. And I remember in 1983, Don Valentine, the founder of Sequoia, lecturing our class on how there was too much money chasing too few deals. So that has always been the case. I don't think Bill was talking about a bubble. Bill thinks that it doesn't make sense for people to be financing companies privately the way that they are. He thinks that companies would be far better served going public.
What about this? In the bubble of the late 90s, which exploded around 2000, you said that you believed the smart people knew that it was a bubble and that they knew that it still made financial sense to be in there as long as you got out before you got into trouble, that you were aware of it back then. Is there also an awareness right now internally that you have that, look, this is a little bit too much, but I can't not do anything and I've got to jump in there?
I think this is a radically different time.
Oh, I think I just lost you there for a second, Andy. Oh, there we go. Radically different time, you were saying, yes?
Unfortunately, I can hear you just fine, but your video just stopped.
Okay, it should come back. Is it back?
No.
I'll call you right back.
There it is.
There we go. Okay, yeah. So you're saying it's a radically different time, yes?
It's a radically different time in that, if you remember, in 1999, companies were going public that were still in beta. They didn't even have revenues. And many companies were going public based on revenue momentum with negative gross margins. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about you, but I think I could build a pretty good business if I handed people money to take my product.
Okay.
So what's going on today, to me, is nothing like that. You have companies that are going public now that have hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue and are cash flow positive. Valuations are way up, I'll agree to that, but these are much, much more substantive businesses. So there's no comparison in my mind between what's going on today and what happened in the late 1990s.
Okay, then let's go on to the other point, which was the transition, which was really smooth. You're not with
Ben. Are you talking about the transition of the partners of the firm?
Yes, of you. You're not a partner anymore, right?
I am not.
You're not a partner.
The title of alumni partner.
That's a title?
I think that's my title.
How did you make the transition so smooth?
Well, when we started the firm, we were very unusual in that our number one goal as a group and what unified the people who started the firm was we wanted to build the best firm in the business. Now, very few people in the venture capital business aspire to be the best because you don't need to be the best to make a lot of money. We didn't really care about the money. We cared about the position. So we were riveted on trying to build the best firm in the business. So we did something that we advise our startups to do, which is figure out who your closest competitor is and then turn their greatest strengths into their greatest weaknesses. Mm-hmm. So when we started in 1995, by far the leading player in the venture early stage high-tech venture capital world was Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. And their two greatest strengths were they had the world's greatest venture capitalist in John Doerr, and they were known for their keiretsu, so their network of portfolio companies. And Kleiner's reputation back then was that if you become part of the Kleiner portfolio, you have a tremendous advantage in working with the other Kleiner portfolio companies. Mm-hmm. So we tried to turn those two advantages into disadvantages. Well, how do you combat a great individual with a team? So we decided that we had to build a fantastic team, and the best way to build that team was through an equal partnership. This is communist capitalism, what we used to refer to as. And no one had ever done that before, I think, because of greed. So in a traditional venture capital firm, you have a hierarchy that the more senior partners own more of the economics, the more junior partners own less. But the dirty little secret is the junior partners generate all the returns. So we said that we wanted to build an equal partnership in order to attract the best talent. And the idea was that in future years, if someone had a choice between joining us as a partner or joining another firm as a junior partner, they'd rather join us because they'd be an equal. We think that's played out. So the idea of the always equal partnership was critical to combat the superb individual. Now, the other partners at Kleiner at the time were very, very good, but entrepreneurs were very disappointed when they didn't get John Doerr, and John couldn't do every one of their deals. He didn't have enough capacity.
What do you do about the I never know how to pronounce that word, the network. Keretsu.
So that's number two. So the positive is that you have a leg up in working with the Kleiner companies. The negative was a lot of entrepreneurs felt pressured into working with the Kleiner portfolio, whether they wanted to or not. Mm-hmm. So we positioned against that by saying, you're the star, we're the stagehand. Kleiner often took the title of chairman in their companies, which was a little off-putting to the entrepreneurs because it was their companies. So we made a really big deal about, we're here to help you get what you want accomplished. You're not here to serve our portfolio. And after all, a lot of entrepreneurs start companies because they don't want to be told what to do. So we thought this played really well there. So back to the equal partnership, the Blood Brothers pact that we made when we got started was that the only way an equal partnership would work is if any of the partners got to the point that they weren't willing to put in 110%, they had to opt out. And I mean completely out, because this is not a business that lends itself to part-timers. Not if you want to be the best. Mm-hmm. If you want to do well, you can have part-time partners. If you want to be the best, you need everybody killing themselves to win. So our attitude was, if you're not willing to go 110%, you finish your portfolio, and at the next fund, you get zero equity. So that means as a founder, there's no goodwill. My goodwill is my legacy. Uh-huh. And that allowed us. So if you didn't do this, the pie would keep on shrinking. If you kept adding more and more partners in an equal partnership, there wouldn't be a great economic incentive. But if everyone opts out who's no longer working 110%, then there's plenty of pie left. So we were able to recruit first Dave Byrne, and then Bill Gurley, and then Peter Fenton, and then Mitch Lasky, and then Matt Kohler, and Eric Vishria. And so we've been able to recruit just superb people who are arguably better than we were, and they're doing as good, if not a better job. So I think the system works.
Does that then put pressure on them to ask you to leave because you're collecting?
No, you never ask. If you have to ask someone to leave, they should be fired.
And if you left, it wasn't because they said, hey, we're producing so much more than you. It was you thinking, I'm not going to kill myself anymore.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you said that
thing?
That's a hard thing to decide. Do you remember when you decided it?
Absolutely.
When?
When I reached the point that I would rather go to one of my kids' ball games than make another call. And we spent the first 3 months together discussing culture, not strategy, because culture endures and strategy changes.
I see.
And we had been heavily influenced by a book called Built to Last. It was written by a Stanford Business School professor and lecturer that talked about how the companies that endure, and that meant a lot to us, to build a franchise that would endure, because three of the five founders came from two of the top five firms, TBI and Merrill Pickard Anderson and Iyer, that didn't endure. So we chose an architectural name because we wanted something that would endure. And our legacy meant more to us than the economics. Our market position and legacy meant a lot more to us. So it was genuine. And anyone who joined the firm, if it wasn't important to them to build the number one firm in the business and to continue this culture, then they wouldn't have been hired no matter how great an investor they were.
Why not go bigger then? How did
doesn't scale.
It doesn't scale. What happens if you would have, what would have happened if you tried to go bigger?
The problem with venture capital is the way that you make money is by taking risk. Mm-hmm. Without risk, there is no reward. That's something that I think distinguishes the premier firms from everybody else. They know which leaps of faith to take. But you have to take risk to get reward. Mm-hmm. You have to bet on companies that are contrarian. They're contrarian at the time you invest. Later on, you say, oh, of course that made sense. eBay. You know, until eBay went public, our colleagues in the industry said, Beanie Babies? Really? That makes no sense to me. And if you look at all of our big, big winners, they all had a component to them of that contrarianism. So you need to take risk. And the more people you have around the table, the less willing as a group you are to take risk.
Why? Because someone can say that's too risky for me and then help opt everyone else out?
Well, you get more and more people. It bogs down the conversations and you can't move as quickly.
I see.
And so again, if we wanted to maximize our cash flow, we would have, we were the first to build international funds. And what we realized was it distracted us from what we wanted to do, which was early stage invest, be the best at early stage investing in the U.S. We made a very nice living doing that. We could pass up on the extra money from overseas funds. We didn't need growth funds. We didn't need seed funds. We wanted to put all of our wood behind one arrowhead to build the best early stage firm in the business.
When you say the best, what does that mean? Is it defined by a metric of success?
It isn't. I think our returns speak for themselves. I can't imagine over the last 20 years any venture firm having a higher return than we did. Our first fund, I think, was the number one performing venture fund of all time. But best in our minds is defined by what the entrepreneurial community thinks.
So that they think, but how do you measure that? How do you know that they...
Well, it's pretty clear. I mean, the fact that you introduced me the way that you did, I think speaks volumes about that.
Yeah, you know what? I can't define it either, but I do know as I was bringing up your name, as I was bringing up your firm's name, as I was bringing up your legacy, definitely people are in awe and appreciate it. But I get it. I feel like we're in a world of metrics, though, that maybe you guys had some metric and you said, this is what we need. We need to be in the top, I don't know, 5 IPOs every year or else... Whatever.
Something, these numbers, it's hard to measure that. Just like within our firm, we knew that we would not have equal performance, even though we have equal economics, because luck plays a big role in all of it. Mm-hmm. As long as each of us was making the same level of effort and had the same kind of impact on people, we thought that would further the reputation.
Let's talk San Francisco. That seems to have been a big thing, right? For people, or am I making too big of a deal out of it? I'm trying to read your face to see if maybe I'm thinking that this is more than it was.
I don't think it was a really big deal. When I graduated from business school, the vast majority of the venture firms were still in San Francisco. The last one to move from San Francisco to Menlo Park was Kleiner Perkins.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they were the absolute last.
I always know them. I remember actually coming to San Francisco and then saying, I'm going to go down. For people who don't know, it's just like an hour drive south of San Francisco where you get to see the venture firms right now. And you get to see companies like Google and LinkedIn and all the rest. And so you're saying it used to be here in San Francisco. Then it became more of a South Bay thing. And
now it's moved up. And my take on it is that in the early days of the business, it was a San Francisco thing because a lot of the players came from financial backgrounds, so they might have worked in the financial district. Therefore, the firms were based in the financial district. They all started to move down to the valley to be closer to the companies because they didn't like the commute. Every day you had to commute back and forth to get to the companies.
Yeah.
So they all started moving down to the peninsula, investing in companies in the valley. And guess what? Of late, most of the companies are starting in San Francisco. So what do? You open your office in San Francisco so you can be closer to
And that's a harder move, though, because you guys moved to from like a pretty grimy part of San Francisco. I'm in the financial district. This is really nice over here, frankly. I can't get a sandwich for less than $12. You moved into a grimier part of San Francisco than I did. And it's a harder move because South Bay is a nicer environment. You get to see more sun. You get more space.
Where are the entrepreneurs? That's
right,
called?
Right there in the grimy part. So that's what it is that you guys said, look, we are well off enough to be anywhere. We're choosing to be in a place here that's a little bit tougher to be in because we want to be closer to the entrepreneur. That's who we are.
The only thing that matters is the entrepreneur. The limited partner doesn't matter. No one matters other than the entrepreneur.
Makes sense. All right, let me talk about a sponsor. And then I also want to ask you, I forgot to intro this, your Stanford class and product market fit. I want to understand what, having gone through all these companies, what you understood. And then I want to get into Wealthfront because I'm really excited about Wealthfront. I had no idea that this was even a possibility. And as I think for me, it's an especially compelling possibility, especially compelling company, because I'm a bit of a chicken when it comes to investing my money. I like to take risks, but you know, not with the money that I've made. But first, I've got to tell people about a company called TopTal. This is the place where you – do you know about TopTal, or am I about to
open it?
You do not? Oh, this is wonderful.
So I'm learning too.
Here's the thing about TopTal. These guys decided, look, there are a lot of companies trying to hire. The problem with hiring is that it takes too long. The problem with hiring is it's a very expensive process. It's drawn out. They said, you know what? We're going to put together a series of really challenging tests for developers. We're going to make it really hard for developers to actually get past – our whole sequence of tests for them. And if they do, they'll be in our network of developers. So when a company needs to hire an individual developer, a team of developers, anything in between, well, they come to TopTal, they talk to a real human being, they say, here's our culture, here's how we work, here's the kind of developer we need, here are the languages that we're working in. TopTal goes into their network and they bring the best of the best and they make a match. And if it's a match, you often get to hire them, Andy, within a day or two, you get to start up with them. And so that's the whole idea behind TopTal. They actually raised money from Andreessen Horowitz, and they've just been growing beyond that. They went from just developers to designers. Now they've got a whole division that lets you hire MBAs. So if you need a consultant to help with the finances, help you think through your business, they got that whole thing. They've been with us for a long time here at Mixergy because companies are actually hiring from TopTal, and they are sending me thank you notes. They're sending TopTal thank you notes, and they continue to keep hiring from them. So I'm going to continue to read ads from them. Also, because it was started by a Mixergy fan, I'll tell you that they're offering Mixergy listeners something really special that you can't get anywhere else. I'm going to read it exactly from their website and then give you the URL where you can take advantage of it. The deal is Mixergy listeners are going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours, and that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Again, it's top as in top of the mountain, tal as in talent. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. To get that. All right. Andy, the class that you taught, was it, how much was product market fit a part of that class?
Well, I taught a number of courses at Stanford.
Okay.
One of the courses that I helped create is called Aligning Startups with Their Markets. And it's all about the importance of product market fit to the success of a startup and how you go about optimizing it.
What's the importance of product market fit? Why is that something that you've talked about so much?
Well, I think it is the absolute key to success. So the pithy way that I tried to explain this is that when a lousy management team meets a great market, market wins. When a great management team meets a lousy market, market wins. And when a great management team meets a great market, something really special happens.
I see.
If you look at the vast majority of very successful startups, they didn't have the world's best management teams in the early days, but they happened to have conceived or pivoted into, more likely, an idea that really addressed an amazing point of pain around which consumers were desperate for a solution.
Can you give me an example of a pain that consumers were desperate that then became a big business?
Name a company.
I'm going to name Google for a reason.
Okay. So Google, let's talk about their business model.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when they ultimately decided to do the text ads, the alternative in the market at the time were display ads. The only way you could advertise on the internet were display ads. And they, because they were sold through a direct sales force, Yahoo required a minimum order buy of $10,000 per month. And back in the day, you probably didn't have a designer on staff, believe it or not. Designers were not an important function in internet companies back then. So you had to pay a graphic designer $2,000 to $5,000 to design the ad. So the minimum you were in for was $12,000 or $15,000. Startups couldn't afford that, so they didn't advertise on Yahoo or display networks. When Google introduced text ads, now you could buy an ad for $1, and there was no sales force, and it was self-service, and it would go up immediately. Well, guess who the original customers were for Google Text Ads? They weren't big companies, because a picture is worth 1,000 words. Why would I advertise with 6-word text ad? The original customers were the people who were desperate to use internet ads but couldn't afford them. Startups.
I see.
Now, once Google proved the efficacy of that, then they were able to expand in a larger company.
Do you think that they understood that that was the problem the way that you just described it? Or did they just hear, I think it was, I read from Bill Gross that this is the way that GoTo.com was doing it. You should copy it. And they said, let's copy what's working for someone else.
Want them to copy it. It destroyed him.
He didn't say copy it. I think it was like, was it a partnership or something that brought it up? No.
They just copied it.
They
just copied it and used it to their advantage, except they did it direct, whereas Overture, which was what Bill Gross's company was renamed, did on an OEM basis for other websites.
Right, that you didn't go to GoTo.com, you went to someone else's.
Here's another example. Airbnb, when it started, it was purely accidental. You know, one of the three founders had actually moved out of their apartment in San Francisco, and the two remaining what became founders needed some money to make their rent. So a design conference came to town, and they rented out Nate's room, and they were amazed at the amount of people who were willing to pay to rent out a room. So they tried to build an event-based business, a service around events.
Right.
And they found some data that ultimately caused them to pivot into non-event-based business. So you often stumble into your product market fit. And what we've found, my teaching partner and I, Bill Barnett, have found is that serendipity plays a role in finding product market fit, but the process to get to serendipity is incredibly consistent. So what we do is we teach what that incredibly consistent process has been.
Can you give me an overview? So just to be clear, you're saying in the case of Google, it's not like they understood that companies had a problem of spending too much money on designing the ads, spending too much money up front, and they said, we're going to come up with this alternative. It's not like they understood that pain. They just kind of lucked into it. Is that right?
I think luck is too strong.
Luck is not the word, but they happened into it.
Steve Blank wrote an amazing book called 4 Steps to the Epiphany that really started this whole idea of a customer development process. Mm-hmm. And then Eric Ries wrote the equivalent of the New Testament, which was a much more readable version of 4 Steps to the Epiphany called The Lean Startup, which is now an incredibly popular book. So what Steve came up with was, I think, absolutely brilliant way to help startups. And basically what he said was, startups should apply the scientific method just like scientists do, that you should start with a hypothesis, test the hypothesis, prove it, and then move on. And if your hypothesis cannot be proven correct, then you iterate on the hypothesis. Steve further observed, and we had backed Steve three times over the years in my previous firm, so I knew him really well. He had observed that in contrast to what most people think entrepreneurship is, which is looking at a market, evaluating a market to try to find the holes or the problems and developing solutions to those problems, that leads to very mundane outcomes. Okay. The truly great technology companies are the exact opposite. They are the result of an inflection point in technology that allows the founder to conceive a new kind of product. The question then is, who wants to buy my product? So you start with the product and try to find the market, as opposed to starting with the market to find the product.
So you're saying it's not even finding the pain, it's not even finding the market, it's finding new technology and say, what can I apply this to?
And then figure out who wants that.
And then what's the iterative process there? Because doesn't Steve Blank say, talk to your customers, test and see, and same thing with...
So what he and Eric Ries have come up with,
yep,
is an idea that first you need to define and test your value hypothesis, and then only once proven do you move on to what's known as a growth hypothesis. So the value hypothesis defines the what, the who, and the how. What are you going to build for... who is desperate for it, and what's the business model you're going to use to deliver it?
Okay.
Until you prove your value hypothesis, you waste money to try to acquire, spend money trying to acquire customers.
Yep.
Unfortunately, most people try to get the growth before they've proven the value hypothesis. So you don't want to get the cart ahead of the horse. That was one of his key concepts. Now, within the value hypothesis, people think I should iterate on the product till I find something people want. No. You stick with the product. You figure out if the first group I approach isn't desperate, then I'll try to find a different group that's desperate. Now, most people don't do that. Most people just keep on trying more people to see if somebody's got to want it. The first class in my product market fit class, I ask, should everyone like your initial idea? And the answer is absolutely not. Because if they do, then the only reason they do is they've been conditioned to like it by someone else. That means people aren't desperate for it because somebody else is serving it.
Do you have an example of a desperate need that you saw that didn't seem obvious at the time? Because
I'll tell you Wealthfront. How about an example?
Yeah, let's talk about Wealthfront then.
So the vast majority of investors in the United States are delegators versus do-it-yourselfers. They want somebody to manage their investments for them. You hear more from the do-it-yourselfers because they're more vocal.
These are the people who are on E-Trade. They're the people who are Charles Schwab, et cetera.
Exactly. But they're about a quarter of the audience, and about 75% of investors prefer to have someone do it for them.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to afford a financial advisor to manage your money, mm-hmm. you typically need a minimum of at least $1 million.
Okay.
So what do you do if you have $100,000?
If you have $100,000, then don't you put it into a managed fund, which is not the same?
What's a managed fund?
Is it a managed fund? Isn't it a managed fund where I say I want to invest in this kind of company and there's someone who will manage it? Am I wrong?
Like a mutual fund?
Yeah, right.
All right. So what kind of mix of mutual funds do you put together?
Ah, right. Okay. Then I pick it out myself or I go to a financial advisor.
You need $1 million to do it for you.
Or I Yelp someone and I find a guy in a small office who will help me figure it out. Or I get a broker. None of that. Isn't that the way it was done? That somebody who wanted to not manage? Well, you tell me.
So you're left out.
Okay.
If you have less than $1 million, you cannot get your money managed well.
Okay.
And so what we did is we came in with a solution with less than $1 million who wanted to invest like multimillionaires. So basically what we did was we're taking all of the services that are offered by private wealth managers. These are really high-end financial advisors who serve people with minimums of $5, $10, or $15 million. And through software, we make their services available to the masses.
Is it a professional on the other end of it, or is it software?
So what we've done is we have a group of phenomenal PhDs that basically clone the services that are delivered through an individual, but software does a much better job of these services than people can.
So how did you know this was a problem? There's no one who's walking around going, I can't get someone to manage my money because I don't have $1 million. They're not complaining about it vocally. They're not going on Quora and asking, how can I have someone manage my money if I have less than $1 million?
Actually, they do, but that wasn't it.
So what did you do?
Here's how I came up with the idea. And I think great ideas find you. You don't find them. You know, if you sit in a room trying to figure out what company should I start, then by definition, you're starting with the market trying to come up with a solution, and that leads to mundane ideas. And just let me give you a framework for thinking about that. My investment idol is a guy named Howard Marks, who founded a company called Oaktree, which is one of the leading distressed debt investors in the world. And Howard is as famous for his quarterly letter to his investors as he is for his fantastic returns. And all of his letters are based on the same framework. Howard describes the investment business with a 2x2 matrix. And I think this matrix describes entrepreneurship as well. On one dimension, you can either be wrong or right. And on the other dimension, you can either be consensus or non-consensus. Now, clearly, if you're wrong, you don't make money. But what most people don't realize is if you're right in consensus, you don't make money because all the returns get arbitraged away. The only way to make outsized returns is to be right in non-consensus. So okay. Starting with the market to try to find a problem, everybody can do that. That's a writing consensus approach to entrepreneurship. The starting with an inflection point in technology, looking for which allows you to build a product and find a solution, that is non-consensus. If it works, it works big. And that's where the great venture capitalists all focus, back to the point I made earlier. So in my case, I was sitting in a Penn endowment meeting. So I had retired from Benchmark in 2005, and I have a life well beyond anything I ever could have imagined. So I wanted to give back. So I decided to teach at my grad school alma mater, and I went on the board of trustees of my undergrad school, University of Pennsylvania. My wife and I started an innovative cancer research funding initiative. But one of my responsibilities as a Penn trustee was to sit on the investment board. I think we have the eighth largest endowment in the U.S. And all the premier university endowments are the best managed large pools of capital in the world. This is very well understood in the investment community. Well, as luck would have it, one day they started telling us about how they did what they did. And they were doing it with spreadsheets and arcane tools. And I don't know why, but it sparked this memory that I had that over the years, I had recruited many people to my portfolio companies who went on to financial success. And they would often come to me for investment advice. And I could never tell them to do what I do because they couldn't afford the minimums associated with the best investment products and services. Uh-huh. Even those who had made $1 or $5 million still couldn't afford access to the best products. And that really bothered me. So I was sitting in this room, and I knew about these new APIs that were being created by brokerage firms. And I thought, oh my God, you could, through software, you could do an 80-20 on what the university endowments do, thereby solving this problem that I've been hearing about for ages. So I decided to go and try that as a hobby, and it turned into a business.
Aren't you there in that case finding a problem that's percolating, that bothered you, that gnawed at you for a long time and saying...
But I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't known about the inflection point in technology.
I see. And the inflection point...
opportunity.
And how do the APIs fit into this?
Well, our service was not possible until you could fund an account electronically, sign up for it electronically, and trade it electronically. If we had to have people helping you with all of those things, then we couldn't charge a fee that's a tiny fraction of what a traditional advisor might charge.
I see. And so there you had this idea.
And without software doing everything, we couldn't have lowered the minimum to $500. So we're giving you what someone who has a minimum in excess of $1 million does for a minimum of $500.
So someone,
the fee.
You want someone who has $500 to come and work with you guys to put their money into Wealthfront? That's not too small for you?
No.
And what they do is they go
that's
in and
small for software. That's the beauty of software, is how scalable it is.
Yeah, I guess it is. I always think of someone who just has $500, at least in the financial world, as just being too little to be worth
because you don't have the time to spend on their account.
What about customer service even?
They don't need service. If you're completely transparent in what you do, if you charge a fair and low fee and you make everything obvious, do you need to talk to somebody to get an Uber ride?
No.
Do you need to talk to someone to rent an Airbnb room? Do you need to talk to someone to buy something on Amazon? No. Let me tell you, do you need to talk to someone to book a flight? You used to have travel agents.
In fact, if you want to talk to someone about a flight, you can't get to them. I see.
Well, we offer client service, but we make it incredibly easy. And actually, software does a better job than traditional investment advisors because it does things continuously that they can only do periodically.
All right. I want to ask you about something that you told me before we started that I was surprised that you were so open about, and we'll get to that. And then I also want to ask you about your desk, which I've heard is really different and interesting, and I'll ask you about that. And then also the evolution of this company of Wealthfront. But first, I should tell people about design crowd. And if you're listening to me, in fact, if you're looking at me, Andy, you would not look at me and say, Andrew is a design nerd in any way. Look at my haircut. I buzzed it this morning, right? I like that you said, Andrew, you're doing video. Let me go and position my camera so I have the oars in back of me instead of the half of whatever you had, the clock, half a clock behind you, right? You cared about it to that degree. Design just makes me so anxious. I can't even articulate what I want to designers. I can't even, let alone create it. So the cover for my podcast was just this ugly thing that I knew was bad. I know enough about design to know it's not good. But I didn't know how to articulate to a designer what I was looking for. And I was intimidated, frankly, of even using my sponsor. I know that the design crowd had helped people, but I was intimidated about it. And then one Friday night, my wife was out. I was just sitting at home. I said, I don't feel like doing anything. I was watching Shark Tank because one of the sharks is going to be on Mixergy. I said, let's just go and do it. And it was just like one box. I said, you know what? I have some opinions. I really hate when you can't see what the podcast is about. So I wrote that. I want a design that looks like where you can read the title of the podcast. I don't need the logo to be so big. So I wrote that. Then I said, I really like these designs that have just one big bold color, because in the iTunes store, there are tons of different cover arts. You can't figure out what's going on in some of these things. It's too small. So I started filling it out. And I said, you know what? I actually have opinions. I hit submit and I said, let's see what happens. Well, because they're a sponsor, I used a URL that they're giving our audience. I forget what the exact price was, but super cheap. I said, all right, you know what? I'm just going to put my credit card down. I put my credit card down. I hit submit and I forgot about it. I went on to Shark Tank. Monday I come in. I have an assistant who goes through my email with me because I get so much email. And I get an email from Design Crowd. You've got a bunch of designs. So I click over and, for someone like me to have a design that looks as good as any one of these, it's shocking. It's like an ugly guy who suddenly gets to date a beautiful woman and he's going, really me? So I had that moment. And I was so excited. I started to like star the ones that I liked. I started to give feedback to them. They redesigned it. There was one that I asked for in green that they gave me in yellow because I asked for a variation. Oh, so beautiful. Listen to me. If you've heard me talk about Design Crowd before and now you're seeing this excitement, it's because I love good design, but I don't know how to get to it. And now I got to it because of Design Crowd. It cost me very little. I forget the exact number. I don't want to get it wrong. Very little, because they're offering Mixergy people $100 off. All you have to do is go to, let me actually check this out, designcrowd.com/Mixergy. I believe it's $100 off. It's a big discount. Go to design, yeah, save up to $100 on custom design. Go to designcrowd.com/Mixergy. I posted it on Facebook. Others now have gone to them and then showed what they got from Design Crowd. You're going to be as excited as I am, and they are. I promise you. Go to designcrowd.com. You'll get a designers from all over the world, each one giving you a design. You get to give them feedback. They then go and rework it. Other people jump in, and suddenly you have dozens of designs. In my case, it was 56 so far. And then you pick the one that you want, and you pay for it. Beautiful, beautiful. designcrowd.com/Mixergy. Here's the thing. You told me before we started, I dig, by the way, that I get to watch you as I do this. That I saw your smile as I was getting excited. I said, all right, I'm on the right track here with this. It's kind of weird to just record an ad. I know Jason Calacanis, who we both know, he records his ad sometimes just into a camera. It's a little tough. I like to have a person there. See, am I on the right track or not? Anyway, I found an old video of you with Kara Swisher back when she was holding her phone up like this, interviewing you about this company, Wealthfront. But it was called something else at the time. What was Ka-ching. It? And what's the origin? Sorry?
Ka-ching.
Ka-ching. What was the origin of Wealthfront before Wealthfront? What was going on there?
This is a great example of what I teach in product market fit. You know, this has been a wonderful laboratory for me to really work through my ideas. So the original idea from the Penn Endowment was that the premier university endowments are able to identify investment managers who are likely to outperform the market. But in order to do so, they need access to all of their trading data to be able to do certain types of attribution analysis that mutual funds don't allow because they're opaque. And so our thought was that if we could apply this Ivy League endowment to investment managers' data, then we could help people pick ideal managers, and we could bring the minimums down from $1 million to $10,000.
I see.
So we built this marketplace of investment managers, and we attracted something like $30 million over a year and a half. Now, we had doubled in the last 6 months, but we only had about 10 months of cash left. And having been a venture capitalist, I knew that we were not going to raise more venture capital doing this, and we couldn't get to break even on the path we were pursuing. So I decided to, I had really asked a number of people in the company to reach out to clients, to non-clients, actually people who hadn't signed up, to find out why they hadn't. And an interesting thing is that this is a generational thing, that a lot of young people don't like talking to prospects. They like looking at the behavioral data, they like emailing, they like surveys, but it's uncomfortable to actually reach out to someone and ask, why didn't you want to use our service? So after asking a bunch of people in the company to do it, I finally had to do it myself. And I got incredibly consistent feedback, which was, we'd rather that you manage our entire portfolio adequately and inexpensively than a portion of it superbly. Our old service was really only appropriate for your U.S. stock allocation, which is typically about a third of your portfolio. And I thought, A, this is incredibly consistent feedback, and B, it's a lot easier to do than what we were doing. So we decided to pursue the lean startup methodology. We started with a concierge approach where we offered the service with paper and pencil to see if people were desperate. They seemed to be. We then built a prototype. When people started saying, please take my money, then we knew it was time to launch, and it worked from the beginning. And now, 5 years later, we have more than $5 billion under management.
$5
billion. Yes.
And that number just keeps growing and growing. The more I go back in time to look at old articles, it's like, we can't wait to get, we were $100 million, and then I saw an article saying, well, $1 billion would be a big milestone, then $1 billion you hit, and now it's five.
I think we had more than $230 million of deposits in January alone.
In January.
Yeah.
Wow. So let me just break that down. You made the phone calls yourself because the people who were working with you just didn't feel as excited about doing it.
No, it wasn't that they didn't feel excited. They weren't comfortable.
Comfortable. I actually was trying to soften it because I didn't want to put them down for enough. I'm surprised that someone wouldn't feel comfortable wanting to talk to a customer, but maybe I shouldn't be. But what did you understand from – how did you ask them questions? What did they tell you that let you understand that they wanted you to manage all of their money well and that they had – other money somewhere else? What was that whole question process like?
Well, it was pretty straightforward. You know, one of the things that we do that's unique in the financial services industry is that we don't ask for your contact information until you open an account. And we actually show you what we're going to give you before we ask for any identifying information.
So I can fill out not a survey, but I can tell you how risk tolerant I am, et cetera. And then I still get some information back. And only afterwards do you ask for contact.
Yes. So today we even tell you what we will buy on your behalf. So if you want to take that and do it yourself, you're welcome to. Because do-it-yourselfers are never going to become clients anyway. And a delegator would gladly pay us to do it, our modest fee, to do it for them. So it sleeves off of a vest.
Okay, so then what was going on in those phone calls that helped you understand what they want you to create?
So what we did was the only contact information we had was for people who started an application that didn't complete it.
Okay.
So I reached out to the people who had started an application and chose not to fund the account. Mm-hmm. And I emailed them telling them what I would like to do. And the fact that I was the co-founder made it, I guess, more credible. And they were willing, some portion of them were willing to talk. I talked to about 30 of them, and the message was just unbelievably consistent as to why they ultimately didn't pull the trigger.
That they have all this other money, and unless you take it all, they just don't want to have somebody handle a small portion of it, a third or so.
So the value proposition was that we can choose managers who'll outperform the market. Mm-hmm. And this is actually where I violated a rule that I teach my students.
Okay.
So, which, you know, in hindsight, I'm really upset about. But I teach my students, never project yourself onto your customer base because you're not necessarily the customer. The same goes for when you're evaluating an idea. I can't tell you how many people say, well, I wouldn't use that, therefore it's a bad idea. And that's irrelevant. The only thing that matters is, does the target customer want this? So So the thing that I violate is over the year and a half that we manage that marketplace of investment managers, post-selection, the managers on average outperformed the S&P 500 by 4% net of fees. That's ungodly. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to represent that we're going to continue at that rate, but let's say that we could continue to outperform by 1% a year, and you gave us $50,000, okay? So, or $50,000, or you had $50,000 and you gave us 30% of that, mm-hmm. that's $15,000. If I were to get you another 1%, I'm getting you another $150 a year.
See,
is it worth it to you to split your money up into multiple locations for an incremental $150? Probably not. But if you've got $500,000 or $5 million, it is. But that's not the audience we were targeting. And of course, it wasn't convenient enough.
I see. And it's through those phone calls that you understood it. And then where did you get to the point of you used the word desperate that I wrote down in my notes. What was the point where they were desperate for?
Well, I've reduced my entire product market fit class to one question.
Uh-huh.
And that is, what do you uniquely offer that people desperately want? Because if they're not desperate, there's a good enough alternative.
Okay.
And let me tell you, if there's a good enough alternative, you're doomed.
Okay.
So as a startup, if you want to build a big business, an advantaged business, people need to be desperate. And so what I learned was that people who were delegators couldn't afford the minimums associated with advisors, and they were desperate to have someone do it for them.
I see. And that's what you're picking up on. You did it by hand. You went all automated. How did you know that all automation was the way to go? And then why now are you guys transitioning to automation plus people for picking?
We're not transitioning to automation.
You're not?
No, quite the contrary. What we're doing is we're taking even higher end services that no one ever envisioned being able to be delivered through software. For example, on February 2nd, we launched financial planning.
Mm-hmm.
So financial planners are no different than travel agents. When they meet with you, they interview you for the inputs to a commercial software package that they all use.
I see.
They go back into their office, they type in your inputs, they bring them back to you 2 weeks later, and then show them to you. You edit them, they go back to their desk, input them again.
I've literally seen this, by the way. I've seen financial planners do that.
Okay, well, with APIs, I can now access all of your information, and I have a much better idea of what your spending and your savings are than you could guess right now. So number one, it's a lot more convenient. You don't need the interview. Number two, it's immediate. You see the results immediately.
I see.
And it's interactive. You can immediately play with them to change the assumptions.
I see. And it would be things like when do I plan to retire? Do I have a home or not? That kind of thing.
How long do you plan on living? Do you think that you might need your savings rate might decline because you're putting your kids through college? In future releases, we'll show the interaction of your retirement savings with your college savings for your kids. Or, you know, our target audience are under 40. So they might be saving to buy a home. That's not what a financial planner typically deals with for someone who has a minimum of $1 million. So we think we can deliver a radically better solution through software, just like Expedia and others probably do a hell of a lot better job than a travel agent.
I'm trying to think of when someone goes to a financial planner. It's often something like their company gives them some kind of investment product or a collection of options. They don't know what to pick, and they go there. Do you guys handle that?
Of course. That's all in the software.
So you go into the software, I go to Wealthfront, and I say, look, here.
They'll tell you what's ideal for your situation.
I see. And it's all automated.
All automated.
No more people.
You don't need people.
When did you come to that realization?
What would you rather have working for you? Three PhDs from Harvard, Stanford, and Princeton designing what was ideal for you, or a guy who graduated from Dubuque University doing your financial plan?
I see. And you're saying your software was created by those guys, the best.
Well, no, the investment products were conceived by finance PhDs. And our chief investment officer is Bert Malkiel, the man who invented the index fund, who wrote a famous book called A Random Walk Down Wall Street.
Yeah.
So you're getting the best of the best designing solutions for you personally.
What are you doing about new companies now, like Robinhood, who are saying we're not going to charge anything? That's not your market.
That's not, well, Robinhood is focused on the do-it-yourselfer. So they build a solution to allow you to trade stocks for free. We think that Robinhood is a nice complement for people's play money. So it's really, it's like dieting. If I asked you to eat nothing but salad and broccoli every day, you're not going to keep up with that after a while. So if we tell you investing is boring, you shouldn't try to outperform the market. You just buy index funds and you rebalance them and you minimize the taxes on them and so on. Well, that's boring. People want to play. So what we tell them is, why not put aside 10% of your money into play money, and you can see how you do with that, and put 90% of it into a long-term stable kind of plan like ours. And we think Robinhood is a great way for you to play. Or if you're a do-it-yourselfer, it's a very cost-effective way of doing that.
I asked someone on your team, I said, I see you guys advertising everywhere, and what's your ad? And she said, no, we don't. She did the same thing that you just did right now. She squinted. She said, we don't buy a bunch of ads.
Our competitors do.
Your competitors do, but I still know Wealthfront. It's because of the PR. And what else? Why? How are you getting customers if you're not buying ads?
Well, we started, so I'm a big believer. Another thing that I teach in my product market fit class is the importance of the technology adoption lifecycle that was promoted by Jeffrey Moore in a famous book called Crossing the Chasm, a book that every entrepreneur needs to read.
And no one reads anymore.
No, in the 90s, it was the lean startup of the 90s.
Meaning like all the innovators read that book, and now all the innovators are going after the lean startup methodology and forgetting about that book.
Exactly. And so the basic premise of the book is, if you want to build a big business, you don't go after the big market first, because those people only buy based on references and you don't have the references. Mm-hmm. So you need to create a beachhead, a niche that you can dominate. And then through references, you grow from that niche of early adopters. So our early adopters were people who worked in tech companies in Silicon Valley. Because one of our investors actually had this great insight. At our board meeting just prior to our launch of the current service, I said, I'm really convinced that what we offer is compelling. The problem is people don't know how to evaluate a financial advisor, so they use the only proxy they know, which is assets under management, figuring that someone who has more assets under management must be better. Nothing could be further from the truth. That means they're good salespeople, not that they're good investors.
Okay.
So one of our investors, a former partner of Kleiner Perkins, by the way, said, you know, Andy, I think you would be well served to focus on people here in Silicon Valley, young people here in Silicon Valley, because they'll care more about the quality of the user experience than they will the assets under management, especially given your reputation, the reputation of the management team.
Yeah.
That was the best advice we've ever got. So we started with young people in tech, and we started with engineers in tech, and then they told the product managers and the biz dev people and the salespeople, and then they told their friends who they went to college with, who might be lawyers or doctors, but not yet rich. There's a term for it, Henry, I think. High earning, not rich yet.
Okay.
So they told their friends about it locally, and then they told their friends about it nationally, and it just kept on growing through word of mouth. And we also did something that, because we were initially focused on young people in tech, we decided to use an internet business model versus a financial services business model. Mm-hmm. So the traditional financial services business model is you charge a high fee for small accounts, and then you decrease the price as the account increases. We did the opposite. We modeled after Dropbox. So just like back in the day, Dropbox gave you 2 gigs for free and 250 megs for everybody you invited and the invitee, we offered 10K managed for free. And for everyone you invite, you and the invitee each get another $5K managed for free. So if you invite five of your friends, you're now up to $35,000 managed for free.
I see.
And this was an incredibly economic way to drive our usage.
I had no idea. And so what percentage of your customers are coming through this invitation process?
A third.
A third?
Yeah.
Through the Dropbox methodology?
Yes.
And the least amount that someone could put in is $500.
Correct.
So if like I want to try software, I can go and try it for free. If there's like email marketing software that I don't want to move away from mine, I want to try someone else, I can
premium,
go try it for
baby.
Free. Same thing here. $500, I go try completely for free.
Yes. Why is it that Wall Street doesn't do this? Because they don't like the little guy.
They don't like the little guy. I was even a little skeptical that there was value in the little guy, but I understand what you're saying now. The little guy comes in and he grows with you and then also could potentially market to his boss and to get more free work. I see. And then for someone who says to you, Andy, but you're going after Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is a small part of the world. Why are you staying in this bubble? You're going to say, I'm focused on this niche because?
That's where we started. That was a beachhead. It's now 40% of our clientele. So we're in all 50 states. Actually, when we did a query the other day of how many states you were in, the answer came back 53. And I remember in
school. How do you get another three?
Well, it turns out Washington, D.C. is considered a state.
Okay.
And then there are two military regions. We have close to 1,000 members, service members as clients, because it's set it and forget it. When they get deployed, they don't have to worry about it.
I see. Well, why don't we just close out with this last question? I asked someone on your team, I said, is there something about color, something that gives me a sense of who he is? Like, what's his desk like? And you're smiling. What is your desk like? You know the answer.
Well, we look like every other consumer internet company you'll ever visit, which means everyone has a desk that's I'm looking at them now, they're maybe 4 feet by 5 feet, and they're all next to one another. It's a big bullpen. And I move around every 2 weeks.
So you'll be in one desk today, another desk the next few weeks, and just keep so that you can get a sense of the whole company.
Yeah. And it makes them feel valued, that I care about their function and want to know what's going on in their function as well. And it keeps us really flat.
Well, I've got to tell you, people keep asking me about celebrities. Do you want to have Richard Branson on, or ask me about celebrities who I've had on? And I've got to tell you, to me, yeah, I do it because it's great for the audience, to build up the audience excitement. But for me, having you on here is a bigger honor. Man, the things that you have built, the fact that you would even go, I think says so much that you went to Stanford and you taught a class on this. I love that you're willing to just talk about how you think about business, what you've learned over the years. And if you gave me nothing but that, I'd be excited. But now to also find out about Wealthfront, I'm really super excited to have you on here. I'm going to hold it there, because when I get excited, apparently I don't use my words properly. So I'm just going to say instead, thank
you
so much for doing this.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right. And the site for anyone who wants to go check it out, it's Wealthfront. And of course, my two sponsors.
Wealthfront.com. But for your listeners, we'll make a special offer. How about this?
Good, I dig it.
Go to wealthfront.com/mixerg. We'll give your listeners an extra $5K managed for free.
Extra
when you open the account, they'll get $15K managed for free.
All right. And then when they tell their friends, they'll get another $5K and another $5K and another $5K.
Exactly.
Cool.
And your friends get it too.
Okay. I'm going to go check it out. I'm going to actually sign up. Because frankly, as I was researching this, I got really excited. I said, why don't I do this? Here's the thing. I'm kind of a chicken. I like that. I made my money. I don't need to lose it at this point. I'll take risks with Bork. I'm not going to take risks with what I've earned.
A low risk portfolio.
Right. I like that. And yeah, I like it. I've talked about that in the past, but I'm very low risk when it comes to my savings. And, I like that I get a little bit of place where I can tweak it. So I'm not super low risk, but I'm not high risk either. And I get to go in and tweak the system. Wealthfront.com/mixergy if you want to check it out. And of course, my two sponsors, the company that will help you hire your next great developer, toptal.com/mixergy, and the company that will help you design your next logo, website, anything at all, designcrowd.com/mixergy. Andy, it's an honor. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, everyone.